Good morning. This is Laura Friedman from American Surfeast Now. Yariv, are you on the call? Okay, so for anybody holding, we're just going to wait another minute or so until we get Yariv on the call. It's about 2 minutes to 10, and we'll be getting started soon. Thank you for your patience.
Hello?
Hello, Yariv.
Hi, Laura. How are you? Hello?
Hello, Yariv. Can you hear me?
Yes,
Yariv?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you
yes,
fine.
Yes, I can hear
we're
you.
We're going to get another minute or so, and then we'll get started.
Okay.
Okay, so people are still calling in, but I think just to respect people's time on a Friday morning, we're going to get started on time, very unusual. I want to welcome people to this APN briefing call on this Friday morning with Yariv Oppenheimer. I want to especially welcome friends and acquaintances on the West Coast, where it is appallingly early, so we appreciate you getting up for the call. I know I got emails from people saying they were getting on, so we'll see if they did. My name is Laura Friedman. I'm the Director of Policy and Government Relations at Americans for Peace Now here in Washington, D.C. I am very, very pleased and proud to have with us today my friend and colleague, Yariv Oppenheimer, who is the Secretary General of Peace Now in Israel. I think most of you know Yariv certainly by reputation. We posted earlier this week an article that he wrote in Yediot Aronot, which I strongly recommend. You can see that in English at our website, www.peacenow.org. Yariv is one of the prominent, the most prominent voices today in Israel, leading the fight for peace in the two-state solution. I want to remind people this call is being recorded. Right now you are in a listen-only mode where you are forced to listen to Yariv as he has a conversation with me. When our conversation is over, I will switch it into a mode where you all can ask questions, at which point I'll tell you how to do that. So the subject of our call today is Migron, and Yariv and I are going to have a conversation about this. Yariv, I actually want to just start off. Maybe you can update people a little bit. People saw the news last week that the Supreme Court of Israel finally ordered the evacuation of Migron after Peace Now waged this multi-year battle. And they saw the news early this week that the evacuation had actually been carried out. Can you talk to us, first of all, just about where things are on the ground in terms of what happened, where the settlers had moved to, that sort of thing, and then we can get into a conversation about the implications of all this.
Yeah, of course. Hi, Laura. Thank you for having me. Hi, everyone. Actually, this is the first weekend in which the outpost Migron is evacuated from people. It's actually empty, and there are no people there anymore, no settlers living there anymore. The settlers moved, most of them moved to a new neighborhood 1 kilometer south of Migron that was established especially for them. It's a much smaller place, but it's still a new place that was built in a very massive and quick time schedule. and most of them are living there already. The houses inside the outpost, the original outpost, the houses in Migwon are still there, and they will be there until next Tuesday. The order of the Supreme Court was that these houses should be removed, but the Supreme Court gave the state some more time to do so. There is another few caravans, maybe four or five caravans, that might stay there for another 2 months, just because the government asked to allow them to be there, because the settlers are keep saying that they bought part of the land of the Palestinians. But I think that the main challenge will be on that issue is also to make sure that eventually the Palestinians will have an access to this place, because one of the major reasons to the evacuation of Migwon is the fact that this outpost was established on private Palestinian land. And it's not just a political struggle between left and right, between progressive and settlers. It's also a struggle about the human rights and whether you can enforce human rights in the West Bank. And the reason why the state and the Supreme Court were very clear about evacuation of this outpost is also about the right of the Palestinians to own land and to work on their land. So we still have a challenge on the human rights issue to make sure that eventually the Palestinians will have an access to this place and they will be able to use the land in order to do agriculture and other things that they would like to do.
All right, so that's a good segue. So clearly the battle, even over the land of Migron, is not over. There are other outposts in the West Bank. There's the fact that the settlers were removed from Migron, but in order to remove them, a new settlement neighborhood was established. We've seen in the Israeli press, we've heard commentary, you know, the argument being that this is fine, it's a victory, but it's a Pyrrhic victory. You know, can you talk to us a little bit about why this was important, what peace now set out to achieve within the limitations of reality, and why you see this as actually a victory and not, as some people in the Israeli press have suggested, just, you know, another sad step towards more settlements?
The settlers has a very clear policy. When they win the election and they have a right-wing government, they will try to push this right-wing government to build settlements all around the West Bank and also to expand existing settlements. When they are not winning the election, or they are winning the election but the government is refusing to do so, they are building illegal outposts and actually creating effects on the ground that will create a new reality in the West Bank. Now, we didn't think that in order to pull out from the West Bank and to evacuate the settlements, all of them, and to have peace treaty, the way to do it is by going to the Supreme Court and to challenge the legal system in Israel. This was not the case. What we thought that is necessary is to make it very clear to the settlers that they cannot make the decision for all of us. The only people that can make the decision, and there is controversial whether they can do it or not, but according to the Israeli law, they can do it and they can establish, for example, a new settlement, is the government. And if the government is doing it, so we will demonstrate, we will try to challenge this decision, but eventually it's legal according to the Israeli law. But when the settlers are doing it by themselves, they're actually creating facts on the ground that will be very problematic in the future in order to reach an agreement. So the struggle here was not just about the evacuation of all of the West Bank. It was a struggle about the system. Before Migwon, or during the time that Migwon was established, and Migwon is the biggest outpost in the West Bank, it's a symbol of a system. During the time Migwon established, many other outposts were established as well. And I'm very proud to say that since the Migwon issue is there, and it's very clear that everyone knew that eventually it will be evacuated, at least we knew about it, the settlers started to be much more careful. And the number of new outposts was getting much lower, almost zero in the last few years. Most of the outposts didn't develop. And the system of creating facts on the ground for the government and making the decision for all of us without any legal procedure, without any state decision, this system failed. And I think that one of the things that we achieve here, we didn't achieve a peace treaty, but we achieved something that is making very clear to the settlers that they should not do it and they should not build new settlements just because they want to. The second thing is that there is also the aspect of the human rights issue and the fact that the settlers know that once they will grab Palestinian land, there are groups like Peace Now that will locate this issue, that will work together with the local Palestinians, and eventually will force the settlers to move out. It's true that it's not perfect, and we didn't achieve peace treaty, and we didn't achieve evacuation of all of the settlements. We will not be able to do it by going to the Supreme Court. We will be able to do it through election and a democratic process. But we create a very clear red line to the settlers, what they can and what they cannot do in the West Bank, and this is very important. And we also help Palestinians that really lost their land in order to get it back. Last remark, it's also not just about what's going on in the West Bank itself. It's also what's going on in the minds of the Israelis. And during the time that we were struggling on the issue of Migron, the Israelis exposed to the system of the settlers that it's a very ugly system, a system that tried to grab land, tried to dictate whatever they want. And actually, they look very bad in the Migron case. And I think that they harmed themselves a lot. And we had the ability to expose it because we know that. We know how the settlers are working, but the public didn't know. And now we expose them in many ways, and people understand what is the system there and what is going on the minds of these people and how they don't have limits and they can try to do whatever they like. And for that reason, I think that also in the minds of the Israelis, we contribute to the feeling, the negative feeling toward the settlements and much more positive feelings toward the peace camp and even the local Palestinians that are suffering from the action of the settlers.
Yariv, can you talk a little bit? I watched a little of the Israeli news coverage online, and it seemed like the coverage of this was very the stuff like on Channel 2. Some of the reporting, they actually covered this very carefully. They covered it, I think, from what I saw, pretty fairly and accurately in a way that was sympathetic not to any particular political view, but sympathetic very much to what you just said, to the facts, to laying out sort of what was going on. And the coverage didn't seem to make the settlers look very good. Can you talk about the Israeli media sort of buzz around this, the news part of it?
The Israeli media create a lot of expectations before the evacuation of this outpost, and the feeling that we had is that this evacuation will be a violent one. And also we know that many of the settlers thought that the best thing that will be is that it will be violent evacuation because they're afraid of a quiet evacuation that will show to the public that after the government was so afraid of evacuation Migron and after they took so many years, eventually you can evacuate the biggest outpost in the West Bank in a few hours. So they try also to give the press the feeling that it might be very violent. Eventually, I don't know if we were surprised, but the opposite happened, and the press has nothing to say. But look, the outpost is evacuated. First of all, the decision of the Supreme Court is being enforced, and second, it's not impossible to pull out from the biggest outpost in the West Bank. And it doesn't mean that tomorrow morning all the Israeli society will be in a civil war mood. And this is a very important thing that we try to emphasize through the media, that this devil is not so big, and it's there is a possibility to overcome it. And we should not be so afraid of the threats of the settlers, because eventually many times evacuation will go smoothly, quietly. It's not a pleasant sight, and we will prefer it will never happen because we will prefer that they will not build in the first place. But once they are doing it, it's not a pleasant sight, but it's something that the Israeli society can accept, and it's not a national trauma or fighting or civil rights or things like that. The media, by the way, like some of the politicians, got very close to the settlers. And because the settlers of Migron, they are not violent, but they acted in a very selfish way during the time of the legal discussion. So we found it that the press is not so sympathetic to their cause anymore, and we even found right-wing ministers that spoke out publicly against the settlers of Migron, saying that they are very selfish and they are just keeping, they are just demanding more and more. So I think that the settlers contribute a lot to a negative image and less sympathetic image that they thought that they will get after the evacuation will be completed.
Let me just pick up on something that you were talking about just now. I think all of us who follow this issue closely, we remember the scenes around the Gaza disengagement. We remember the confrontations, the violent scenes around Amona. We have been following the price tag campaign, the death threats against you and your colleagues at Peace Now. It seems that there has certainly been an effort to create the sense that violence is uncontrollable and inevitable if the government takes on the settlers. To what extent does this experience at Migron not only show that it's not obviously inevitable, this was not a violent confrontation, did not involve violent confrontations, but to what extent does it also put the responsibility for the violence now on the settler leadership, who in the past said, oh, we can't control the settler youth. We can't control them if they're righteous and angry. You know, it's one of these things that happens. Clearly, it doesn't happen. I mean, it seems they can turn it on and off. So how will that change the perception of settler violence going forward?
I think that eventually in the minds of most of the Israelis, the evacuation of Migron and the previous evacuation of the Ulpana houses that were evacuated a few weeks ago, that went smoothly and quietly also, both of them shows the Israeli public eventually that it's possible to evacuate the settlers, at least a part of them from the houses. And nothing, the sky will not, and this is an option. On the other hand, we need to look also on the other side, and the fact that the reason for that is that they evacuate quietly is that they got some things in return from the government, especially this new neighborhood that they got in return of the outpost. It's a bad news, but it gave them the excuse to evacuate themselves quietly. Still, I think that if I'm looking at the balances, I think that the fact that in the minds of the Israelis, also in the minds of the government, first of all, the settlers and the settler leadership should be accountable for any act of violence or most of the action of violence, because when they want, they can restrain, they can stop the youth from becoming violent. And second, that it's possible to evacuate the settlements, and we should not be so afraid about even the thinking about evacuation of outposts and settlements. Just a reminder, before the first evacuation of the Ulpana, Netanyahu himself said publicly that to evacuate the houses of the Ulpana is something that the public cannot take. And we saw that it was one of the non-issues in the media because it was so quiet, so the media lost interest very quickly about it, and it went very smoothly. So the lesson, the message to the Israelis, and we try to push forward this message, although the government is paying a huge price for that, and not a huge, but a price for that, and we disagree about it, eventually, when there is a decision to evacuate settlements or settlers, it's something that is possible to do.
Okay, one more question, I think we'll open it up. On the issue of, and you said this, I mean, obviously it's possible it didn't spark a civil war, all of that. What were there, you know, I watched again the Israeli press, I didn't see it. Were there people out in the streets? You know, we've often said that the average Israeli doesn't seem to actually care that much about settlements. They don't. They need to be reminded that they're there a lot of the time. I mean, did we see any evidence here during this battle over Migron, which the settlers had really, you know, set up to be a litmus test for this government on settlements? Did we see a sense that the average Israeli cares about the fate of Migron or individual settlements all that much? And testing the whole argument that, you know, if you go after settlements, the government will fall. Well, clearly it didn't. It didn't fall over Migron. So can you talk about those two things?
We didn't see any, not even small demonstration of of even settlers themselves or people that support the settlers inside Israel and in the West Bank. And I have to say that personally I was surprised that it went so smoothly and so quietly, maybe because the settlers themselves in one point understood that there is an ideological struggle about the fate of the West Bank and the fate of Israel and the fate of Israel democracy, as I see it. But there is also another struggle about the rule of law. And when there is a decision of the Supreme Court to evacuate an illegal outpost like Migron, so people should respect the rule of law and people should respect the Supreme Court decision. And I think that eventually the knowledge of the mainstream Israelis is that the settlers are the ones that are breaking the law, and at least there is peace now in the Supreme Court that is doing peace now, not in the Supreme Court, but peace now challenging the legal system and eventually creating a Supreme Court decision that that evacuate this outpost. And this is a major issue in which we got points in the Israeli public, and I think that the settlers as a whole lost a lot of credibility among the Israelis.
And on the issue of whether, again, I've heard from people in Washington when we talked about settlements going back to the beginning of the Obama administration when settlements were the issue. And we heard over and over, you can't ask Bibi to do things he can't do. You can't ask him to take on the settlements directly. It'll bring down his government. Can you talk about what this experience teaches us about the strength or fragility of an Israeli government coalition?
I think that Netanyahu understands that if he is making the decision, and he's this time I'm sad to say that this decision was a bit forced on him, but eventually when he's making the decision to evacuate outposts or settlements, when he's making the decision at the beginning of his term to freeze settlements activity in all of the West Bank, including what is being called the settlements blocks, he can do it, and he can still be prime minister. And Netanyahu, at least for the right wing, is the best candidate that they can have. So they are not so enthusiastic about trying to replace him. But sometimes, like in America with the Obama administration then and with the Supreme Court today, Netanyahu will not do it by himself. He needs to be pressurized in order to do the right thing. And this is I'm sad for that, but I'm very committed to keep pressuring Netanyahu to do the right thing and not to be so afraid of these settlers that has a very strong political lobby. They got access to the media. They got many young people that are ready to break the law in order to physically protest. But eventually, when Netanyahu is making the decision, so life going on and we can continue our lives, and sometimes it's even non-news.
All right, and I lied. I'm going to ask you one last question before I open it up. What can you tell us, or can you tell us anything about future, ongoing and future legal efforts by Peace Now related to the outpost, settlements, private land, that kind of thing?
There are a few procedures that are being discussed in the Supreme Court regarding other outposts. The most interesting one is Givat Asaf. It's much more radical outpost. Also on private Palestinian land. There is also the place of Amona that is on private Palestinian land, and we expect more discussions about it and more Supreme Court hearing about it in the next few months. We don't see anything concrete that will happen in the next few weeks. But we are also looking closely about what will be the outcome of the Migron verdict, whether the state is going to respect this verdict, whether the Palestinians will be able to go back to their place, and also to challenge any other illegal construction in the West Bank. Just a few days ago, we discovered a very small outpost that is being built next to the fence in Israel, and we are now thinking about the way to stop it. But I think that the Migron case gave us a lot of credit also among the legal system, that when we are doing a legal procedure, we have the figures, we have the information, we are coming in a very serious way, and eventually our claims are being approved by the state and after it by the Supreme Court itself.
Great. Okay, so now I am going to switch us into Q&A mode, so bear with me for one moment. All right, so I ask people, if you want to ask Gary a question, you need to press *6 on your keypad, and I ask people to please introduce yourselves before you ask a question and to remember that you are being recorded. So, and if multiple people speak up at once, we'll just deal with that. So if someone wants to go ahead with the first question. That's painful. Do we have somebody on the line?
Hi, okay. This is Ted Lieberman.
It's Marianne.
Great, Ted, go
can
ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, whoever is speaking, we're going to let Ted Lieberman ask his call first, and then I hear a female voice. Who will be next?
It's Marianne.
Oh, hi, Marianne. So you're after Ted. Go ahead, Mr. Lieberman.
Yariv, thank you. Hi, Yariv. I have two quick questions. One, have the police made any significant progress in arresting or curtailing the perpetrators of the price tag operations? And secondly, can you tell us what you think will happen in terms of any Israeli strike against Iran before the U.S. election?
Hey, thank you for the questions. It's very difficult to predict those two. The first issue is about the price tag. There was one major price tag event and some other that got less media, but one major one inside Israel on a church in the city, in the center of the country. I doubt it. I don't know if the police will be able to catch these people. They are making an effort. I don't know if it's enough. I don't have the tools in order to predict whether they eventually will find these people. But once they are finding these people, the sad thing is that mostly we are talking about very young people. Just a few weeks ago, there was a Molotov bottle that was thrown on a Palestinian cab, and a whole family was badly wounded. And the people, and the police, and the secret service eventually caught the people that did it, and the people that did it are 12 years old children. So it's not just about the people that are doing it. It's also about the system of education that they are getting or not getting, the values that they are exposed to, or the non-violent values that they are exposed to. And I think that it's very important that we will not just see whether the police caught one person or another. It's about the system and what's going on in the radical settlers' education system, what's going on in the houses of these people, what is the very ugly negative reaction of some of the Israelis that are keep writing nasty remarks about this action, supporting people that are doing this kind of action, not the politicians, but the people themselves. And I think that is a bigger question whether this specific person will be caught or not. Regarding the Iranian issue, it's a big question mark. Netanyahu is all the time sending mixed messages. In the last few days, we thought that there is a chance that due to the fact that Obama and Netanyahu are going to meet soon, there is a postponement of the plans to attack Iran. On the other hand, we got a former, a very important Likud member that said today that the next 50 days are going to be crucial to the security of Israel. So it's very hard. I can bet, and I can say my personal feeling, I don't see Netanyahu doing that, especially when he got all the military people inside Israel against this kind of attack. But I have no way to predict eventually what he will do. So we will have to try to make an influence that it will not happen, but also to wait and see. It's very unclear.
Marianne, you want to go ahead?
Yes. Hi, Yariv. Respect to...
Hi, Marianne.
Hi. What you said about the youth of the people who are doing this. I remember from even several years ago that parents were pushing their children to be the perpetrators of acts against the Palestinians because they would not, according to the law, they basically wouldn't suffer any punishment. So I'm wondering whether one tactic ought to be to go after the parents to advocate for some kind of action against them. That's one question. And the other one is, what's happening with the slap suits?
We there?
The suits, the lawsuits that, Imtiaz Sue and Elad are bringing against the rights groups for libel.
About the Facebook group that was...
About the lawsuits that Elad and been filing for libel against groups who are trying to decry their tactics.
Yeah. Regarding the punishment for the parents, according to the Israeli law, the parents cannot be punished for the things that their children did. I hope I understand the question correctly. And I don't think it's going to change. I think that what is important for us is to emphasize all the time that when you are in a place that you are in an occupation, not in a democratic place, and when you add to that also some religious view that are taking the religious issue to a different place, eventually you will find yourself with an education system in the West Bank that is racist, that is problematic, and not doing anything in order to stop this kind of hatred crimes. So I think that this is something that we have to aim. I don't know if punishing the parents will be an option according to the Israeli law. I doubt
it at all.
You commented on it.
I did.
Facebook Insight came up in my newsfeed.
And the second question about the Sioux.
But I couldn't tell.
The issue with the Sioux, according, I don't know exactly.
Elad
case.
They're totally funny.
Okay, good.
Somebody
Hello?
Can hear you.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The Elad case, we won the Elad case, and now they try to appeal about it. So it's a procedure that we will continue to go, but I think that we have a good chance to take it down from eventually. And the Intel 2 case is a more complicated one because they are saying that they are not fascist, and there is a more principled debate, whether a legal debate, whether they are or not. Most of the Israelis don't know about these things, and it's mostly a way of the right wing, first of all, to make us very busy, second, to get our money sometimes, and third, to make us so careful so we will not say what we think or what we know, even if we are sure of that, just because we don't want to find ourselves sitting in courts in many discussions that has no political value and eventually will create us losing money for lawyers and etc. and time and energy. I personally had two procedures like that against not the Yesha Council but something close to the Yesha Council, another settlement movement, and one of these procedures ended after a few weeks, and the other one eventually stopped. But this is something that they are trying to do all the time in order to keep us busy and in order to force us to lose money and lose time and lose energy. They are not gaining points, and even if they will win some of the things, most of the Israeli public don't find interest in that, and the Israeli media is also don't like to cover it, not when we are winning and not when we are losing, because the Israeli media are in some ways in the same place, and they don't want to be sued all the time about things that they write or said.
Thank you.
All right, next question.
Frank Bamberger.
Go ahead, Frank.
This is Frank Bamberger in Brooklyn, a long time Pisnik. Can you talk a little bit about what you see as the political situation? In particular, how do you see the formation of a new centrist party headed by Tzvi Lipny and committed to a two-state solution? Do you see that as going anywhere? Do you see that as hopeful?
I think that it's easier to predict what will happen with Iran than to predict the Israeli political system. But I will try to take this challenge. First of all, there is Yair Lapid, the former journalist that took over the vacuum of Kadima, at least tried to take over the vacuum of Kadima, and to be an alternative to Netanyahu, not personally as a candidate for prime minister, but to be a party that will be alternative to Kadima. And he is already running, and he established a new party, and he is the head of this new party. He is not so committed to most of the things that we are doing. Most of the time he will try to separate himself from the progressive camp, but he is saying all the time, he has this, I think, very good slogan. I hope it's more than a slogan, but the slogan is saying that Netanyahu tried to postpone the solution of the conflict between us and the Palestinians, and to heritage this conflict to the next generation. And he's saying that this is unresponsible. And this is an important message. Livni is saying the same things, but she is now trying to see what she will do. Eventually, most of the political commentators are talking about an option that Livni and Lapid, although they don't like each other so much for now, eventually they will understand that in order to be bigger and to be more serious, they will have to join forces and to run together at the same party. It's early to say whether they will do it, and it's not really clear what will be their support once they will do so. But according to Livni, she's in a very low profile political mood. She's checking her way. And this option about running together with Lapid is on the table.
Thanks.
Thanks, Frank. Next question.
Yeah, it's Todd Feldman from Denver.
Go ahead, Todd.
Yariv, what feedback have you received about the 4% campaign?
Hi, Tom. We didn't get a lot of feedbacks because we didn't push it forward still so much. But it's a good question.
Yariv, why don't you actually, for people on the call who may not know what Tom is referring to, why don't you just briefly describe the campaign?
The 4% campaign is a way to answer those people that are saying that the situation is irreversible and the settlers won the battle and the two-state solution is history. And we thought about, first of all, saying that the number of settlers, not including East Jerusalem, but settlements in the West Bank, the number of people living in the West Bank, Israelis, is only 4% of the population of Israel. Now, if you look at that 4%, when we talked about the ideological settlers that are living in the heart of the West Bank, and for sure will be evacuated, we are talking about 1.6% of the population of Israel. It's not a minor number. But still, this is not a number that will force Palestinians and Israelis to continue this conflict forever or to go for a binational state. And we are still thinking, Tom, about how to market this campaign better. I don't know if the 4% or the 1.6 will be the number of the percent that we would like to emphasize, because there is also a problem to make the definition. Once you are doing it, you are creating a border, and it's a bit complicated. But the bottom line is very clear. We will try to say to the public, first of all, the settlers are the minorities, and it's a small minority. It's not tiny, but it's a small minority, and it cannot dictate the future of the next generation. And second, I think this is another important message. Even if there will be a lot of settlements and a lot of settlers, and even if there will be not 4%, 20%, eventually, the motivation for the two-state solution is not just by the number of settlements or settlers that we will have to evacuate. The motivation for the two-state solution is also the price that Israel will have to pay. And if Israelis will understand the price that we will have to pay for the continuation of the occupation, eventually I think that they will be ready to evacuate even 500,000 people. It's also about the price of what will happen if we will not do it and what will happen until we will do it. And this is very important. Not just the number of settlements or settlers will be the only indicator whether this two-state solution is possible or not.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Yariv. Do we have another question? We're going to go for a couple, just a little bit longer. Hello, I heard somebody dialing. All right, well, while we wait, because I think there are other people dialing, I heard that. Yariv, can you had a piece in Yediot this week, and you touched on it just now in your answer to Tom. I think a lot of us in the peace camp right now, and this has been for a while, but it's building, the sense that we have to defend the fact that the two-state solution is still viable. And, you know, I had this argument with people about Migron, where I say this is a victory for the two-state solution, and they say, come on, get serious. Can you sort of run through a little bit, in a little bit more depth, your answer to that? Because I think you provide a very good answer to that.
Yeah, we are being under attack in some ways. The Yesha Council understand, the leadership of the settlers understood that the best way to win is to convince us that we lost. And we, first of all, we cannot argue that they are in some ways winning. We know that we have a right-wing government. We know that in the last 4 or 5 years they got some achievement. But it's not a zero-sum game, and it's not over yet. And I think that what is important for us to say is, first of all, although we are suffering in the last 4 years, and it's very hard to be a progressive Israeli and to see and to hear what they are doing, still there is no... There wasn't a strategic change in the number of settlers in the West Bank. There wasn't a strategic change in the reality. The number of settlements is the same, and the number of settlers that will have to be evacuated increasing, but not in a strategic way, not something that we didn't expect, not something that is so dramatic. And for that reason, although the minds of us maybe and the minds of the Israelis change, the reality doesn't. And second, and this is what I said before, that we should not give the settlers the ability to make the decision for the state of Israel and to count the number of settlers and to say when we will get to this number, this solution is not relevant anymore. This solution will be relevant if the Israeli public will push forward this decision, and then it will not be really important for them whether we are going to evacuate 50,000 or 100,000 or 150,000. And this is a very important message, that the minds of the Israelis is much more important than what is going on in the West Bank itself. Now, this is a struggle because after 4 difficult years, many good Israelis that are supporting us prefer to take the easy solution to say we are giving up. And it's very easy to give up. I think that we should not give up, and I think that eventually the reality will not allow us to give up. And the Israeli public will get to a place that if it will not go quietly and smoothly, it will be violent and maybe very difficult for Israelis. But one day, Israelis will find themselves saying, okay, we got the message, we have to evacuate the West Bank no matter what, even if there are so many settlers there. Another important argument is that Israel did so many big things, and so many big things are happening all the time. But if you look at Israel, accepted and created a place for 1 million Jews from Russia in 10 years' time. And we are talking about like 10 years that every year we are getting the same amount of settlers that we will have to be evacuated for 10 years. And we did it, and it was eventually successful. So if Israel would like to do it, it's possible. The big question is not how many settlers or settlements is being created, although it's important, and this is why we have the settlements watch and everything. But the main question eventually is the mind of the Israelis. And when the Israelis wants to withdraw from Gaza, when the Israelis wanted to withdraw from Lebanon, when the Israelis supported the peace treaty with Egypt, Israel did it, although the settlers, although the right wing. This will be the case with the West Bank as well. Of course, it will be much more difficult if we will keep on waiting and allowing the settlers to continue to build in the West Bank.
That's Frank Bamberger again. Thanks, Tom, for letting us know about the 4% thing. Can you get us more information about it? Can you get us some links? Or, Lara, can you write about it so that whatever is being thought of in that direction, more of us can be aware of?
Absolutely, Frank. This is something that we're following closely. You know, what Peace Now is doing, so we're taking our lead from them. But you know, as this moves forward in Israel, and I don't know, Yariv, if you want to talk anything about timing or your plans, but you know, certainly we're going to be doing everything we can to amplify this because it's a powerful. It's not just a powerful argument. The facts are powerful. You know, we sometimes say you can have as many opinions as you want. There's only one set of facts. The facts here actually are very, very clear in terms of how much change is happening on the ground, how many people may or may not need to be evacuated, and they are not nearly as daunting as the narrative is that's being created by the settlers at this point that the two-state solution is over. So, Yariv, I don't know if you want to add anything there.
Just to say that we are in a very complicated situation because on the one hand we would like to say to the Israeli public we should not build settlements. Once you build settlements you are creating more problems and it will be much more difficult to achieve the two-state solution. On the other hand, I don't want to let the settlers use the same argument in order to say we won. I think that we are continuing a very difficult struggle. I think that if you are pessimistic you can say there are many settlements or many settlers, but if you are optimistic, if some people will say 4% is very, very small number, and again, Israel will not have to evacuate all the 4%, but some of the people will say it's a huge number. It's also a matter of perspective. Eventually, it's a very complicated thing, but for us, it's very clear that this is a war that we have to take, a war on the mind of the Israelis to keep the two-state solution relevant and not to allow the settlers to create a feeling among the Israelis that they it's not really important whether there will be new settlements or not because game over. We are not in game over and we should not give this present to the settlers for free. This will just help them to make it game over eventually, and we should not collaborate with this attempt.
All right, so unless there's anybody else who has a question that they want to jump in with, Yariv, I want to ask one last question. This is something I know all of us who know Peace Now are thinking about all the time. Can you talk a little bit about sense of security for you, for Hagit, the threats, sort of where that situation is today, particularly after the Migron, in the context of the Migron evacuation and going forward?
Yeah, I think that for the right wing, we became the symbol of the left wing or the progressive people that not only speak out, but also has the ability to influence. And eventually, for most of the right-wing people, although they got some things in return, the evacuation of Migron is a place that they lost. And they feel that they lost for us. And this is important for us, of course, to be at least to show that we have success, even when we are handling a very right-wing government. But it's also a bit scary. And we do get some threats through the media, through the Facebook and the social media and some phone calls. I have to admit that the last few days were more quiet than I expected regarding threats that we got. Mostly Hagit and I, that we are also in the front of the media, in the media, in the Israeli media, we are taking some steps in order to protect ourselves, not something dramatic, but we are very aware about what's going on around us. I don't want to elaborate so much about things specifically. It's not so dramatic. We don't need guards, but we are taking care of that. And the police is involved as well, and we talked with them. I think that eventually there is a very good chance that nothing will happen. I hope, of course, that nothing will happen. But on the other hand, we cannot sit in the shelter and just to not to do anything. It's like driving a car. Eventually, you're taking a risk. Something might happen, and not always you got the control over it. We are doing our best in order to have a seatbelt, I will say, but we are keep on driving.
Thank you, Yuri. We're all worried about you and watching you and inspired by your efforts. So I'm going to bring this call to a close. I want to thank everyone for getting on the call on this early Friday morning. I also want to recommend to people who haven't seen it, there is a joint APN Peace Now publication that went out earlier this week entitled The Top 10 Reasons Why Migron Is Actually a Victory for Peace. And it goes into a lot of the details that Yariv went into and some more technical stuff. I think it's quite helpful in answering the skeptics about why these legal efforts are so important and the very many, sometimes not as obvious, victories that it involves. So that's at www.peacenow.org, and I also want to recommend Yariv's op-ed there. Thank you so much, Yariv, for joining us today, and Shabbat Shalom to everyone on the call.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you, Lara.
Bye.